Well, good morning. My notes tell me that we have students from Edgewood High School with us today, and if so, would they and their advisors please stand? Oh my, a great group. You may be seated.
And a great advisor. Year after year brings this group here.
Very good. The students are here with the program that the Supreme Court operates in coordination with the State Bar of Wisconsin called Court with Class. So they have heard a little bit about the case that we're going to have argued now. And then after this case, one of the justices will meet with them to discuss the Supreme Court and how it fits in our judicial system. It is I who will be meeting with the Edgewood students after this argument, if you are able to stick around. And anybody else that would like to stay is, of course, invited. I'd like to introduce the court to the students and all present. On my far right is Justice Rebecca Bradley. Next to her, Justice Annette Ziegler. Next to me, Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. On my left, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. In the chair next to her, Justice Michael Gableman generally sits. He will be joining us a little later. And on the far end, Justice Daniel Kelly. So with those introductions, are you ready to proceed on State versus Powell? Please go.
May it please the court, I am attorney Philip Rain. I practice out of Janesville. I represent Sam Bath Paul, the defendant in this case. He is a 27-year-old man. The offense in this case happened 3 years ago when he was 24. He is serving 20 years of initial confinement followed by 20 years of extended supervision for this offense. He is not eligible for release until he has served at least 17 years. Only then can he petition for early release pursuant to Section 973.195. My client is raising primarily a constitutional double jeopardy argument. We're arguing that he's being punished twice for the same offense. As alluded to in the last case, the law set forth in State v. Ziegler is the applicable law in determining what the presumptions are. It is my position that these offenses are identical in fact and in law, and therefore the state would have the burden of proving that multiple punishments are appropriate.
Counsel, you had an epiphany. Well, I'll say that anyway. And that is, you sent us a letter February 23rd to advise us that you had come to realize that the statute that we are looking at, 346-67, had been changed by the legislature on March 30th, 2016.
That's correct.
And this is a relatively recent find. Have you had the opportunity to look at the legislative history to determine what occasioned this change in the statute?
I did, and I don't know to what extent that I have a right to quote the legislative history because the other side may not have had that same opportunity that I had to look. But in looking at that change in the statute, it appears that the purpose of the statute was something other than impacting on how many counts were appropriately charged out of any one accident.
Much to your dismay.
Yes, it was.
Okay.
I actually had thought that just looking at the stark reading that was going to be why the change had been made. Obviously, the change was related to a different nuance in the law, which I think had to do with a driver's duty to investigate if they were in something that they believed was an accident. I do think that change in the law is illustrative of the issue today, and I think that it impacts somewhat on how this case would impact on future cases.
Counsel, isn't it telling, though, that the legislature just looked at the statute, could have amended it to provide that there is only one penalty per accident and did not do so, knowing that the law has been in place for almost 30 years?
Yes and no. I think in this particular situation, the legislature did change the language in the very first line from any to a. And even though there is nothing in the legislative history that indicates that the reason why they made the change related to that particular issue, I don't think that it would foreclose the possibility that the legislature made a deliberate choice to go from the word any to a.
Doesn't that support the state's position, though, and its argument about the singular versus plural?
Well, I think if it's A, then it is singular, and then it helps their argument that if there is an accident involving a specific person, then there is a violation of the statute. My view of the current language of the statute is that any is broader, that it can be more than one. So if there is an accident and it involves any person, and that is two people, that is still a single violation of the statute.
Counsel, is that perhaps consequent upon your characterization of the offense as leaving the scene of an accident? Right? And that's traditionally how we refer to the statute.
Yes.
But leaving the scene of the accident is not the only thing it prescribes or prescribes, is it?
It is not.
Okay, so when we look at the things that it prescribes, it says that you must reasonably investigate what was struck, correct?
Yes.
And you're also supposed to give the operator's name and address and registration number of the vehicle to the person struck.
Yes.
And the person is singular.
I would agree with you.
Okay. And if there are more than one person struck, that duty would apply with respect to each person struck, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And you also have to exhibit your operator's license to the person struck?
Yes.
Same thing, right? If there's multiple persons struck, you have to show it to all of them, right?
Yes.
Okay. And similarly, with rendering reasonable assistance, including transporting or arranging for transport for an injured person to a hospital?
I believe there they say any rather than a. Mm-hmm.
Any person injured?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, so that duty would apply to each person that was injured.
I would argue that if you fail to provide aid to any one person as a result of an accident, then you would be in violation of the statute.
Okay. So is it your position then that the legislature intentionally distinguished in subsections A, B, and C here, that the legislature intentionally distinguished between any person in subsection C and person singular in A and B?
Yes, and I think the reason why they did that is with regard to C, the legislature wanted to make it clear that you have a duty to each person that's injured in an accident, and that if you aid three out of four persons, you still are in violation of the statute because you didn't help that fourth person.
How would that differ from A and B? If you showed your operator's license to three of the four, you'd still be in violation, correct?
Yes, but as long as there is one person who is aggrieved by that failure, you've violated the statute. And my argument would be that with regard to A and B, it would be surplusage to say any. You only need one.
Counsel, there's another statute that bears on what occurred here, and that's 346.74. And every paragraph and subsection begins with any person, any person, any person, any person. And they all relate to the penalty for violating the hit-and-run statute. Are we to interpret any person in 346.74 as more than one person? Or the way you're interpreting it in the statute that precedes it?
My interpretation is that it is a yes or no question in terms of reaching what the appropriate penalty section should be. Was there a death? That is a yes or no question.
No, but I'm not focusing on what kind of a consequence occurred because of the hit and run. I'm focusing on the word any. And each time it says, paragraph, subparagraph one, any person, number two, any person, number 2G, any operator, number 2R, any person. And it goes on and on with every lead off with any person. And it's the same phrase that you argue to us includes two people, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Or can, sure.
Okay. And here, how can it include two people? I don't see how it would make sense to have the penalty section for the crime of conviction be for two people. We sentence people one by one by one.
Right. My view of the law on that is that as long as there is one that is sufficient to bring the statute into effect, and any more than one is irrelevant.
Okay.
I understand what Justice Rogan's asking you. I'd like to also follow up on that a little bit, though, because it does talk about any person who violates, right? Meaning the person you're sentencing or the person that you're dealing with, right? But when it talks about penalties and what one should expect, it discusses when the accident involves death to a person, what your penalty is. It's a Class D penalty if it's a person. So doesn't that indicate there should be a penalty for each person?
Right.
And I think that was the question I was trying to answer with you. Is that
that's the question you were answering. That wasn't the question she was asking.
That's right. Right. Yes. I was asking just a statutory
interpretation. And my position is that if you have a death, that is sufficient to make it a Class D felony. And if it is three deaths, it is still a death, and it's still a Class D felony. It doesn't become three Class D felonies.
Well, doesn't it mean that it's a person who violated that section for that death?
Yes.
Okay, and if there were two deaths, then they violated that section twice, didn't they?
And that gets to the essence of my argument. My argument is that because of the terminology in the first sentence of 346.67, when they use the term any instead of a, the legislature did not rule out the possibility that there could be more than one person affected by a single violation of the statute.
Now you've brought yourself back to Chief Justice Rogensack's question,
right,
which is how can you say any means one thing in one section,
right,
and any means something else in
That's
the next?
That's right. That's what I asked.
And maybe I'm missing this. I thought that under 374 sub 5, it talked about A as singular.
It's 346.74, counsel, that I was looking at, which is the penalty for violating 346.67 to 346.73. And it was the sections there where the phrase any person, which is the focus of your argument, is used.
Yes.
Any person as used in sub 2 refers to the defendant. Any person, any defendant violating 346, etc., may be required to forfeit less than and for the first offense, blah, blah, blah. And any operator of vehicle, that's all the defendant. And you're dealing with a statute where you're looking at any person, meaning the victim. Is that
yes.
true?
It is.
So, seems to me your response might be that just because they deal with any person in another statute dealing with the defendant doesn't mean any person means the same thing dealing with a victim in another statute. Isn't that what you're saying?
Yes, I would agree with that characterization.
Although, in all fairness, what person would they be referring to in sub, for example, sub 5, other than the defendant? Because it's only a 346.74 sub 5. Mm-hmm. Any person violating 346.67. Mm-hmm. So it has to be the defendant, right?
Yes.
And then it talks about what they should expect for penalties. And it is a Class D felony if the accident involves death to a person.
Yes.
So if it is a person who's violating that section as to a person, if there are two people, then there's two felonies, isn't there?
And again, I think that you look first at 346.67 to see if there is a violation, and then you go across to 346.74 sub 5 to see what the penalty is for that violation. I don't think 346.74 sub 5 stands on its own and is a separate penalty section.
Well, I think that people, the justices are trying to ask you a question, as I interpret it, which may not be what they're asking, is that 5C says a person is guilty of a Class A felony if the accident involved injury to a person and the person suffered great bodily harm, is guilty of a D felony if the accident involved death to a person. A person is singular, and they're trying to ask you, I think they're asking you, that is guilty of a D felony if the accident involved death to a person, one person, is guilty of a Class D felony if the accident involved death to two people, is guilty of a Class D felony if the accident involved death to a third person, because D is singular, a person. I mean, I think that's what the question is.
Right. And my argument would be that the penalty section in itself does not have any effect. There has to be a violation of 346.67 to get there.
And under your interpretation of 346, it doesn't matter how many people are killed.
That's correct.
It's one offense when you leave the scene of an accident.
That is my position, yes.
What bothered me is if you have a situation where the defendant hits a car, and leaves the scene of the accident, and all the people in the car, of whom there are six, and if it's a big car, eight or five, whatever the number is, and leaves the scene, you know, you got one smash. Everybody's killed. To say that there's only one leaving the scene from one smash sort of made sense to me. When you hit several motorcyclists, it's more than one smash.
I would agree.
There are two or three or four smashes. And it seems to me when you get two or three smashes and you get two or three people injured, that's different than the one smash. How do you respond to that?
I would argue that an accident in common parlance would refer to a chain of events that happens under a relatively short period of time. And in this particular situation, you would have to have, if there's an accident, there is an accident scene, and there has to be flight from that scene in order for the offense to occur.
And this was all one group of motorcyclists, is that clear?
That's correct. There were five motorcyclists in a group. That is how it is defined in the criminal complaint. And I think there's other information within the criminal complaint that indicated that the two motorcycles that were damaged as a result of the accident were found next to each other. And both young men were found on the roadway. And again, my argument would be that there has to be an accident scene for the person to leave. And in this situation where you have two motorcycles that are in close proximity to each other, there is no ability to leave one scene without leaving the other scene, and really they're only one scene. I think the circumstance is that you have the accident scene and then you have the flight from the single accident scene. That's not to say that there could not be a situation where a person hits one motorcycle, drives an appreciable distance down the road and hits a second motorcycle. In that situation, you certainly could have two accident scenes.
Why would that make a significant difference to our analysis?
Because at that point, the criminal defendant is making a second choice, a second decision to leave a scene of carnage that he has created. In the first example, and in this case, he's leaving the same accident scene.
I'd like to get back in line to be behind Justice Abramson when you're done with Justice Kelly's question.
But I think what it comes down to is there's a second mens rea that has been, that the defendant has made a second bad decision by continuing from that second accident.
But he's done essentially the same thing with respect to the individuals that this statute puts a duty on him to assist, right?
Yes.
Failure in accident one, you failed to take that person to the hospital. Accident two, you failed to take another person to the hospital. Why is it different for our analysis that the two victims that you did not take to the hospital are 10 feet apart or a quarter mile?
Because it has to do with that, making that mental decision to leave the scene of the accident, which is the essence of the offense.
It is not the essence of the offense. The essence of the offense is the failure to do the things required by the statute, and they are multiple.
I would
agree. One of them is remaining at the accident scene. The others are not. The others are providing information and rendering assistance.
I would agree, but if you leave the scene of an accident, you necessarily fail to do all of those things.
Well, yes, you can accomplish the violation of the statute in one fell swoop, but that does not change the fact that you owe specific duties to the victims of the accident, does it?
You certainly would have a duty to the individuals, but again, because of the way the statute is worded, I would argue that there is one violation for each accident.
But that's assuming that the essence of the violation, as you put it, is simply leaving the scene of an accident.
Yes. And I think that my position is supported by law that I cited in the brief.
So let me press you on that just a little bit. So let's say he stays at the scene of the accident, but he does not render medical assistance to the injured people. Has he violated the statute?
Absolutely.
Okay. So then why does it matter that the two victims he does not assist are 10 feet apart as opposed to a quarter mile?
Again, I believe that it's because he is making a second decision. And I think, I'm sorry, the other example that I wanted to put out to the court would be a situation where you have a bus driver who's at a stop sign, pulls forward into the lane of travel and is hit by a car who sideswipes the car and continues on. In that situation, we don't have any victims of that offense. The bus driver was not physically harmed. The bus driver was not psychologically harmed. The bus driver was not out aiming from a financial standpoint. So you can have the offense of hit and run without any victims. And that's why I don't think you look at the number of victims in determining whether or not the statute has been violated.
Is your argument purely a constitutional one, or is it one that rests in the statutes? Are you arguing it's multiplicitous? purely as a constitutional matter?
And in the alternative, I would argue that under a TAPA analysis, well, my position would be that the state has the burden of showing that multiple punishments are appropriate. I would argue that even if we proceed under a TAPA analysis, we reach the same result. And I think the statute, because it used the word any, is clear on its face.
Multiple charges, not just multiple punishments, right? Because there have to be two charges here.
There are two charges here, right. Correct.
So do you bear the burden or the state?
My position is that the offenses are the same in fact and in law, so therefore the state would bear the burden. Even if I bared the burden here, I think I could prevail just based on the statutory language and the prescription of the statute, which is not to leave the scene of an accident.
What are the elements of the offense?
The elements would be leaving the scene of an accident before providing your name and other information to any person struck at the scene of the accident, and failing to provide aid to anyone injured as a result of the accident. And again, my position is that if you leave the scene of the accident, you can't do any of those things.
But, okay, go ahead.
Why should we, let me ask that, overrule Hartnick?
Because I don't believe that Hartnick considered a true TAPA analysis in its analysis of the issue. It is a case that's 30 years old. I think in the interim we have several other states who have reached a contrary position on how this issue should be addressed.
With comparing similar or the same statute?
The statute from West Virginia that I cited extensively from my brief, I believe, is exactly the same, and I would believe that most states probably use a template on this type of statute. Thank you.
May it please the court, Dan Lennington for the state of Wisconsin. The two charges in this case are factually different because each charge relates to a separate victim. Therefore, the defendant, and not the state, bears the burden of establishing a clear indication of contrary legislative intent. Paul cannot meet this high burden. In fact, he points to no evidence suggesting that the legislature intended for multiple fatality hit-and-run accidents to result in a single charge. State versus Hartnick holds that multiple charges may result in a case like this, and so does Rabe and Austin. Likewise, hold that there's a presumption in Wisconsin that multiple victims may equate to multiple crimes.
Counselor, just say that you have two charges, just as you do today, but they're tried separately. And in the first trial against the first person that's listed in that count, the state loses. They don't meet their burden of proof. Can they charge this? Can they try the second person, or is he home free because of the failed conviction on the first defendant?
That's an issue of consecutive prosecutions, which is not presented here, but in that hypothetical, it would matter whether the state lost its first trial on an essential element that would also be present in the second one. For example, a case of a poker game where someone is robbing five people and the state loses on intent with the first person, and they go and they try the person subsequently. That's a different type of double jeopardy issue. This is a multiplicity issue.
Okay, so it doesn't rise for us at all here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
So Paul provides no compelling reason to overrule the precedent in this case, and therefore we ask that the Court of Appeals be affirmed. The two-step inquiry in Wisconsin focuses entirely on the intent of the legislature. And this results basically from the language in the Constitution, which uses the phrase same offense. So the question is, what is same offense? And this court in Ziegler has said, and in other cases, that it's a question of legislative intent. And so the test is about who bears the burden. If the offenses are different in fact, then the defendant bears the burden. And here they are different in fact because a different victim was charged in each count separately. This is a proof of an additional fact. And in State versus Rabe, this court said that different charges for different victims can result even under the multiplicity doctrine. That was a drunk driving homicide under a separate statute, but that the principle is very clear that there's a presumption in Wisconsin. When you have different victims, that means there's different crimes. And this has been the precedent for many years, and there's really no compelling reason identified by Paul to overturn this precedent.
Counsel, your counterpart characterizes a violation of the statute as being leaving the scene of an accident. Is that an accurate characterization of this offense?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
The legislature has imposed four or five separate duties under this statute. The first duty is to immediately stop. The second duty is to provide your name, address, registration. The third duty is to show your operator's license. And the fourth duty is to render a type of reasonable assistance, whether it's calling the EMS or making arrangements. There is also a separate duty in subsection 2 called the duty to not obstruct traffic. When you look at these five duties together, you see the legislature was very concerned about not just leaving the scene of an accident as some sort of morally culpable act. It's not just bad in and of itself to leave an accident, but it's bad for certain reasons. It's because the people left there could be helped by your assistance. In this case, the record reflects that one of these individuals was alive when the EMS and paramedics came. And so I don't want to speculate, but that's a situation where perhaps hypothetically the EMS, if called sooner, could have helped one of the victims. And so the legislature since 1911 has been focused on this idea that you have a duty not only just to stop and stay there, but to do things, to take affirmative steps, to provide your name, to make arrangements, to provide reasonable assistance, not to obstruct traffic, to do things. It's not just about stopping at the scene. It's about stopping and helping.
Does the complaint contain any specific subsection of the statute? In other words, is it charging any specific subsection as opposed to all of them, which include, as you just well documented, the requirement to show your license, and et cetera?
It charges everything. It charges all four duties under the complaint, counts one and count two. They're identical except with the victim. It says that Mr. Paul caused an accident resulting in the death of Mitchell in one and Devin in the other, and that he didn't stop, he didn't provide his information, he didn't call for assistance. And so all four of those concepts are in each one.
Let's take a look at the words of the statute. And the argument advanced regarding the difference between any and a makes some sense to me because they mean different things. They're different words. And when I look at 346.67, for instance, let me pull out sub A. The operator shall give his or her name, address, and the registration number of the vehicle he or she is driving to the person struck. Singular, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Let me go down to C then. The operator shall render assistance to any person injured. Not the person injured. I take from, to me, the plain meaning that any there means one or more.
So the state has never taken the position that any person is plural.
Well, under 990.01 singular is plural, also under our statutes, as you know, I can tell by your smile.
So,
but look, there's a difference between the person and any person. I could ask the intelligent students from Edgewood High School right now if they think there's a difference between give the ball to Spot or give any ball to Spot. There's a difference, right? So what difference does that invoke, or what's the meaning of the difference when they say in B or A to the person and C to any person? What does the any mean in C?
Any individual who happens to be needing assistance in that particular circumstance. And the state's position would be that any person is singular just as a person is singular, because the burden is on the defendant to establish a contrary legislative intent. So what I would say in response is that the legislature could easily use plural nouns. They could have said an accident resulting in the death of any people or any persons or any one or more persons or any group of people. They could have said, you should render assistance to the person or person struck, the people struck, the group of persons struck. Could have said, you should provide for the caring of such people or persons to the hospital. It doesn't say any of that. It just says any person, a vehicle, the person struck. And this is illuminated further by the penalty provisions, which use the phrase uniformly as singular as a person struck.
I'm bothered by, for instance, I'll pick now either A or B, which say to the person struck, and C, which says any person injured.
I think any person is used because there may not be someone injured. In the bus driver example, where you can commit this crime just by striking someone's car and leaving without anybody injured. And so you wouldn't have to provide or help to any person injured because there is nobody injured. So when they use the phrase any person, it's conditional on the fact that there could be someone injured, but there might not be someone injured. So you could commit this crime by striking a vehicle and leaving. And so it doesn't have to be a victim involved. But in Wisconsin, there is a presumption that when there's multiple victims, there can be multiple crimes charged. So since the burden is on the defendant, and under these four factors that we look at, the language of the statute, I think we've gone over that sufficiently. I don't think there's anything dispositive in the statute that would weigh on the defendant's side of the scale. And the legislative history, I think, also indicates for over 100 years a legislative intent to focus on the victim, to be victim-centric here, that it's not just morally reprehensible to leave the scene of the crime, but to leave the scene of the crime without helping anybody.
Counsel,
the legislature's... Yes,
what about the statute 990.001 that says... Any singular in the statute includes the plural. Any plural includes the singular.
Well, what I would say is that it wouldn't work. I'm trying to think whether it would work in a multiple homicide case in which there was intentional homicide, whether the defendant could argue that I murdered a group of people and not just one, and so I can only be charged once. So I'm not sure how it works in the context of multiple victims, where there's a presumption of multiple charges.
Why don't you tell us how it would work? Because the statute says, unless otherwise in the statute, otherwise interpreted.
Right. I would say otherwise there's a clear indication here and in the homicide statute that there can be charges for each victim. I think it's clear with the case law of this court and in the face of the statute.
Why is it clear? You're saying it's clear, but why is it clear?
Because what the legislature sought to prescribe is leaving the scene of an accident without helping people, without providing information to the person struck, and that the legislature has never identified leaving the scene of an accident as a single crime. Just in the, when this court decided State versus Rabe, when there was a drunk driving accident with four victims, it could result in four crimes. This court didn't consider, and this was not, issue was not briefed as far as whether this term of statutory construction overrides the or affects the multiplicity doctrine, but I would think that the clear precedent here shows that this is a single crime for each victim. The third factor under TAPA and Ziegler is the nature of the prescribed conduct. Again, this focuses on duties to individual victims and the imposition of four or five specific duties. The legislature could have easily prescribed conduct related to a specific event or accident without the focus on a victim. And in this case, there multiple punishments are appropriate. Each individual victim could benefit in different ways from different acts. One victim may need a driver to render assistance, and one victim may need just the name, address, and registration. So, for example, if this motorcycle accident would have turned out differently, where one person was injured and one person was just knocked off but not injured, the statute focuses on them differently, providing assistance to one, but maybe just exchanging information with the other for insurance purposes. Those are two different needs for each victim, and so there's appropriate punishments for each one, which is why the legislature provided different punishments depending on how each victim was impacted or if there was no victims at all.
If someone is killed, don't you think the operator has to leave his or her identification anyway?
Yes, and I think there's likely a law enforcement purpose to that, and assistance to law enforcement to investigate the crime, to provide your information so that the police officer who responds can take your name and address and perhaps get a statement from you to investigate the crime, which is particularly important when a death is resulting.
Do you think that the amendment to the statute lends any light to this case?
It's clear that the legislature imposed an additional duty. This idea that maybe you're driving late at night and you hear a thump and you need to stop and go look and make sure that no person was struck or no property was damaged, that there is this additional duty to investigate what might have caused the thump. Also I think that there's clarification language, the changing of any person to a person. It is not particularly significant for either side here, but as Justice Rebecca Bradley pointed out, the legislature could have easily taken this opportunity to change what it knew was the status of the law, to change what Hartnick says, to change what Rabe says, and knowing that the legislature presumes to know what the state of the law is, to say, no, what we really mean is that we're going to change the way we've handled hit-and-run accidents for over 100 years. And we're going to say that we are just going to criminalize the actual event of you leaving. And we're not going to put any focus on victims. The legislature could have easily done that, but they chose not to.
What was the date of Kalal?
Kalal versus Dane County, the plain language. Mm-hmm. But that was Justice Sykes wrote that opinion.
Yeah.
I don't remember what the date of that was.
Okay. The reason I'm asking is what we're doing, so what Kalal says, is you got to find the legislative intent, the legislative purpose, right in the language of the statute. And I don't see the legislative purpose or the legislative intent here regarding whether one or two crimes are involved.
Right. I think that Kalal says that you would focus first on the words of the statute, and then if you're going to have to determine the legislative intent, you can look at the context of the statute, which means you can look at multiple versions of the text. You can look at the penalty provision, for example, and the liability portion. You can look about how maybe the language has changed over time, but the focus obviously should be on the text of the statute. And I think the text here is clear that when they are, when the legislature is focusing on rendering assistance to the person struck, that they would provide a penalty for someone who violated that provision.
Yeah, except that once the person leaves the scene, there's no further duty. I mean, the duty is there, but they're not going to obey that duty or deal with that duty. So you've got one thing that the legislature is dealing with, leave the scene.
It's not necessarily binary, because you could stop at the accident and fail to provide certain duties. Like, for example, you could stop and call 911, and you could try to see if the person, you could render assistance, but then you could be scared of your own criminal liability, and you could flee then without staying to provide your name or any other assistance.
Is it your position, then, that a defendant could be charged under A, B, and C with separate violations? Since they're separate duties? One volitional act, perhaps, or perhaps not.
Right.
So what's your position on that?
This is a difficult question.
Good. I'm glad you brought it up.
This is a difficult question. It's not presented by this case. The presumption in Wisconsin, obviously, is that multiple punishments may lead to multiple victims. So that's my answer. The text of the statute, if you'd like an answer, the text of the statute seems to support charges for violations of any portion of the act.
And your argument seems to advance that when you say there are separate duties. That's why I asked the question,
right?
Because it was clear to me that, or it was apparent to me, that when you say each one has a separate duty, that flowing from that is each one, your position is, could be charged separately. And that goes to the whole issue of whether we look at this holistically or individually. So your position analytically, even though the issue isn't presented in this case, your position analytically is that each could be charged separately.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, you would run into problems, wouldn't you, with the penalty provision that I asked opposing counsel at, 346.74, because the penalties are quite different for the different violations. Would be most odd to have a statute interpreted such that when you're leaving the scene of an accident where a person died is meted out under 346.74, and then when you violate some lesser portion, you're also fined $40, or maybe you get fined another smaller amount, and you get different levels of felony convictions for different violations of the duties imposed. Wouldn't you have a problem with the penalty section if you operated that way?
I agree there could be hypothetical situations in which my argument would lead to results that don't quite seem right. Luckily, it's not presented by this case. And
that's a general problem with hypotheticals.
Right.
It's very hard to see through to the end because you haven't briefed them, argued them, and looked at what law might bear on.
There could possibly be an Eighth Amendment problem if there was multiple charges with multiple convictions stacked consecutively, and you could get life in prison for not showing your driver's license to 30 separate people on a school bus, for example. There are obviously hypotheticals, but the important thing here is that the Double Jeopardy Clause is not a command to the legislature about how to draft statutes. It's not a drafting guide. It just provides this simple two-step test from Ziegler, which says if they're factually different, then that Mr. Paul here has to come and explain to you why the legislature meant something completely different than what it seems as on the face. And I think
but
that test works pretty well.
We don't decide cases necessarily just, of course, for the parties involved here. So we take your analysis and we want to know what the consequence of your analysis is. I think the consequence of your analysis is that some prosecutor in Trempealeau County can charge, when you look at it in discrete sections,
can charge each discrete section with each discrete penalty. That's the consequence of your analysis. And although that case isn't here today, it may be here tomorrow, and I don't like that consequence. I think that's going, that may be going too far. Mm-hmm. So realizing it's not the case today, but I think analytically it is a consequence of your argument, alleviate my concerns.
Well, I'm not sure this is going to alleviate your concerns.
Try harder.
I will try. First of all, I would say that if we focus purely on the text of the penalty provision, it says any person violating any provision of 346.67.1. So that indicates to me a legislative intent to create separate crimes for the separate provisions. Now, what I would say is that that rule in this case, while you could conceive of hypothetical circumstances that might seem disagreeable, there are checks and balances on this type of overcharging. For example, the district attorney in Trumbull County is elected. There's a check there. This punishments that are imposed by a court are subject to a cruel and unusual standard. There's due process implications apart, potentially fair notice to the defendant, and all sorts of other protections that could prevent an overzealous prosecution. So I would not be concerned in my position as a state would not be concerned with this particular hypothetical interpretation of taking the legislature at its word when it says any provision is a separate violation.
You give the checks and balances. One is election. I'm not necessarily compelled by that. You give the check and balance on cruel and unusual punishment, but when you're adding up the $50 fine with the $200 fine and the $300 fine, I think that's a far cry from an Eighth Amendment violation. So,
did you get 9 months? Get 9 months under 5B and a Class E felony and then a Class D felony and then the felony not alphabetically named of death. So you have a possibility of five penalties, right?
Yes, and we also...
And you don't want to take the legislature at its word? You think that's what the court does? That's what Kalau says, don't take the legislature at its word?
What I'm focusing on is I take the legislature at its word when it says that any provision is a violation of the statute. And I take this court at its word when it says that each victim is a separate crime and that the presumption in the state about multiple victims and multiple crimes is an admirable rule that we apply, and I think it applies in this case. We also rely on the discretion of judges in their sentencing, judges who take the guidance from this court about what's a reasonable sentence and what's not a reasonable sentence, and what factors should be considered, and what is too harsh, what's an unduly harsh sentence. And all those things protect, in my mind, against an overzealous prosecution. And for these reasons, we ask that you affirm the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel mentioned the Rabe case as supporting his argument. I would argue that Rabe is different than this case, in that in Rabe, the offense is killing another person while intoxicated and driving a vehicle. In that case, the statute uses the term another rather than any. And I think for that reason, that situation is different. Rabe, the whole offense is defined in the statute. I get back to the word any. Words matter. Why did the legislature use the word any as opposed to a, if it didn't mean to make it that you could only have one violation of the statute?
Well, opposing counsel says it's any means there may be none. How about addressing that argument? Any could include none rather than one or two?
Well, if it was none, then there would not be a violation of the statute.
Any. Well, in regard to aid, it wouldn't be, but what about the other obligations that are under the statute? I mean, I thought the argument was interesting, that any could also mean none. So you don't have to give aid except if there is someone that needs aid to be given. Still have to stop, but you don't have to, you know, call the EMTs or whatever.
Yes. But there has to be at least some violation of some subset of the statute.
Well, you have to exhibit your operator's license to the person you struck. You have to give your name and your address and your registration. So there are other things. I think the any comes in with the injury part.
Yes.
So maybe nobody's injured. Maybe that's why they used any.
Counsel, you seem to find some significance in the verbiage of A and B as referring to the person struck being singular. What happens if someone strikes two people?
In that situation, the state prosecuting this would have to point to at least one person who was struck and not properly addressed by the person who struck them.
So, but the statutory language would put a duty on the driver to provide that information to all of the people struck, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So when A and B refer to the person, it actually could refer to any person or all persons.
Right. And I believe that what would be required of the state in that situation is they would have to prove at least one person was aggrieved in that situation. That's all they would have to prove. It's like my burglary analysis where you have four persons who are in a house when a burglar comes in. There's four people aggrieved. The state only has to prove one of those four.
Right. But what I'm trying to get at, though, is you found some significance in the distinction between subparagraph C that referred to any person and subparagraphs A and B that referred to the person. You saw some significance in the singular in the first two and the potential multiple in the third. I'm wondering whether that stands up if one accident results in striking two people.
And the only reason I bring up the any as it relates to injured parties is I believe in Hartnett that is discussed that you have the duty to each individual.
And same would be true with respect to providing the information.
That's correct.
So why do you find any significance in the distinction between any person and the person?
With regard to, in my position on that would be that you have to show at least one. One person was not given the information in order for there to be the violation.
Does that get you your conclusion? I mean, that simply says that that's the prerequisite for the state to charge for anything. But does that mean that that is also the maximum that they can charge?
No. The state would have to be able to point to a death or great bodily harm or bodily harm. They would have to be able to prove that fact up in order to prove the heightened penalties.
Thank you very much. We are now going to take a break for the noontime, and we'll be back again at 1:30 with our third case for the day. If the Edgewood students can stay, I will be right out to chat with you and anybody else that cares to do so. We are adjourned.